By the way, I totally don't recommend, if you're going to play Monopoly with your family at Christmas, do not post videos on social media beforehand explaining the mathematics of how to game Monopoly. Yes. That's a rookie mistake. They tend to get suspicious. Happy New Year, both.
Happy New Year.
Welcome Happy back. New Year, Simon.
We haven't done this for a while. I suppose nominally we're now in season 3 of a podcast that still does not have a name.
Tradition!
Congratulations! Mike, you just got back from Geneva. How was it?
It was beautiful. Christmas Day, 53. Sunny. I went into... got my ankles wet in a river that was very, very cold because rivers are mountain-fed. But it was wonderful. Geneva in the winter, it's kind of situated in a bowl. And so a lot of times there'll be cloud cover. And one day I went up a lift onto the top of one of the mountains. And it's just amazing to, you're going up and then you're in the cloud and then you break through. And it kind of just looks like a giant lake of white clouds as just rushing up on the mountain. It's absolutely gorgeous.
It's kind of like the first time you ever fly on a plane and see that kind of sea of cloud below you. It's like, wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was pretty nice.
Very nice. Sam, did you have a good Christmas?
I did. It was a lovely Christmas. I got books and beer mugs. So it was quite a haul.
It's the best way to do it.
Yeah. How about you?
So we normally would do family split up. We would do each half of my wife's family, one half on Christmas Eve and one half on Christmas Day. But for a variety of reasons, this year we did both halves on Christmas Eve. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not that introverts don't like people. It's just that they wear a stand. And so after, you know, by the time, you know, we finally got done, it was just me and my wife. It's like it's 11 o'clock and we've been going since, you know, 10 a.m., 11 a.m., I was just absolutely wiped out. At this point, I got home for Christmas Mass. It was just like, I don't want to see any other human beings for the next 48 hours. And so we binged through a show called Travelers that just came out on Netflix. And it's I found it a little odd because I haven't seen Eric McCormack in anything since Will and Grace. I know he's done other stuff, but and this is a really serious role, and so it was kind of jarring. But it's kind of like it's like a time travel show, but not a time travel show. It's like it's not like Quantum Leap or 12 Monkeys or something like where the doing of the time travel is a major element of what they're doing. It's more that they come back, and it's kind of like we've talked in previous episodes about Dollhouse and Caprica, and it's kind of like that. The idea is that this team comes back from the future and they imprint themselves onto the brains of a group of people in the current time, now, permanently. And it has these interesting elements similar to Dollhouse. So one of the hosts, I think that's the right term, has brain damage, retardation, whatever. And so this causes the imprint to be kind of unstable. One of the hosts is a heroin addict. And, you know, heroin addiction is a real physical dependency. And so even though the guest, the traveler, is not a heroin addict, the body that is now theirs is physically dependent on heroin. And so was that. It kind of made me think of, well, if you got a doll drunk and swapped their imprint, would the second doll also be drunk? But anyway, it was a really good show. They go off and do all kinds of daring do's. Superb cast, superb supporting cast. I strongly recommend it. It's on Netflix, and I have watched everything except the finale because it hasn't aired in Canada yet. So, and it just seems unfair to get ahead. It's a Canadian show, and it just seems cosmically unfair to get ahead of the Canadians. I've seen Rogue One, and you haven't, so we'll put off talking about that till next time. But what else do we want to talk about? We're in kind of a transition time.
Well, let's start off, as we always do, talking about our beer.
Good call.
I am drinking a Leinkugel Bavarian Dunkel. It's a dark lager. Very good. Very good. Nice, dark, smooth taste.
I have a Sierra Nevada Celebration Fresh Hop IPA. good company, makes lots of good hoppy beers, and this is no exception. This one's a little bit less. They have one called Torpedo that's just way too much for me, but this one is just in the sweet spot and very much enjoying it.
Well, I am currently having a Lindeman's Lambic. This particular one is apple-flavored. On the label it says pomme. It's Belgian, and they speak French, and so they use the French term for apple, which, as an American, I would prefer to call it freedom apples, but, you know.
Oh, come on. When are you going to let that go? Look, as a recovering limey, right, shouldn't I have more against the French than you?
No, I just like to tease a bit.
Mm-hmm. They're Belgians. No one likes the Belgians.
So logically,
everyone likes their chocolate.
Right. Yeah, or their waffles.
Where are we going to situate the capital of our new European Union? I know, let's put it in the country that no one likes.
Well, let's put it in the country that we made up, right? You know, Belgium is not a real... There's no person who is ethnically a Belgian. Hmm. You know, this is the combined two ethnic groups that absolutely hate each other, the Flemish and the Walloon. And, yeah, there is no such thing as a Belgian. It's the perfect place for a capital of a European Union.
So it's synthetic. That,
yeah, it's completely synthetic, just like the European Union.
Isn't that at the root of a lot of the problems in the Middle East? I mean, those are also synthetic nations, but they've been able to be held together kind of in the way that Yugoslavia was, by a succession of strongmen and kings and things that you can rally around in a way that you can't in a democracy.
Yeah, Yugoslavia is a nice tie-in because it strikes me as a similar situation for a lot of the former Soviet states that, as you've mentioned before, were intentionally designed to be unstable.
And we're seeing that play out in some cases. Now, that's an interesting segue because you wanted to talk about Russia, and there's been some interesting Russia stuff going on, or at least some interesting Russia allegations made. What's your take on all this?
My take on this is that I'm disturbed at how lackadaisical the Trump transition team has been about all of this. Like, you know, there's only one way, there's one thing that Putin and the Russians respect, and that's power. And so if we let them get away with this, which... You know, the Obama administration's doing something.
Well, I say, let's bracket what this is for a moment and come back to that.
Yeah, so if you let them get away with this, then it's going to embolden them, it's going to embolden the Chinese and other forces who seek to meddle in our internal affairs and seek to destabilize us and seek to embarrass us on the global scale. You know, it's really concerning for me that we could be seeing, you know, America's diplomatic work of the 20th century start to unravel. Not just NATO, but the world trade regime that we've assembled, which really benefits us. This entire free trade openness really benefits us, and see that entire thing unravel, going back to almost a mercantile system.
I think we should probably explore a little what the this is that you're referring to, because I actually kind of tried to drill down a little into this and get a better sense of what's actually being alleged. And it seems to me that there are two concrete allegations that are kind of bandied around to kind of create the facade of a third, for which there is no evidence. And the third is that, quote-unquote, Russia hacked the election. And you always see in these news reports these kind of vague allegations that they... interfered or hacked or impacted, and they're very vague verbs about what's actually going on. And the impression that I get is that they want to create the idea that actual voting machines were hacked in some way, which isn't the case. It seems to me that what's being alleged are two things. The first is that Russia was behind, or the FSB was behind, the hacks of the DNC, John Podesta, people like this, probably the RNC as well. And then those emails were selectively leaked through the FSB's WikiLeaks front, or possibly WikiLeaks as an independent, useful idiot. And people saw this information and they reacted to it, and that had an effect on the election. But nevertheless, you know, even though you've just found out that your spouse is cheating on you, you should be more concerned about how they found out than the fact that they are. Right? Mm-hmm. That seems to be the idea. It matters more that we only know that Podesta said this because Russia is involved than it matters what he actually said. And then the other part of it is this idea of that there's been a fake news campaign, that parties not entirely clear in Russia plant fake news stories on Twitter and use bots to push up the rankings of those stories through trending and things like this. Mm-hmm. And then that's influencing the election. If that's the case, why is that more troubling or peculiarly troubling because it's a foreign state actor? And why is it especially troubling because it's Russia versus, say, if the BBC was planting stories on Twitter and gaming the trending? Mm-hmm. You're still dealing with something, a comparable situation to Russia for today. I'm sure the BBC wouldn't agree with that characterization. But you're still dealing with a foreign state-controlled media outlet that's putting stories pertinent to the American election into circulation.
Well, it's a bigger deal because Russia has been a historic adversary of the United States and has continued to, like, and has ramped this up in many years, you know, in the recent years. If someone at the BBC had obtained hacked emails or hacked the emails of the DNC and did that, I could imagine a diplomatic row over that. But, you know, there's not the same sort of prime minister, you know, the prime minister isn't seeking to completely undermine American foreign policy.
Yeah, I thought Charlie Cook was quite astute. He was a guest on a different podcast that I listened to. And he pointed out that there's this assumption that Russia was rigging the election for Trump, and that's not actually necessarily correct. Mm-hmm. What they actually might have assumed, like everyone else, was that Hillary Clinton would win and were hoping to discredit her as she walked in the door.
You know, I think they were hoping for Trump, but they're willing to settle for an embarrassed and weakened Hillary Clinton. You know, it's just very unfortunate that we're, like, the United States is just being outmaneuvered at every turn. And, you know, I think we need to do something to kind of save face.
Is the Obama administration's response sufficient for that, do you think?
No.
So let's say we've elected you, President Mike. What would President Mike be doing?
President Mike would be cutting off Russia from major internet servers. Mm-hmm. I'd be, like, the internet runs through us. We haven't handed it over yet.
We control the horizontal, we control the vertical.
Yeah, we control those major access points, and if we choose to, we can cut off Russia from the internet. And perhaps maybe they should have some technical difficulties for a few days, a week. And then they can come and talk to us.
We'll cut off President Putin's favorite websites.
Exactly. You know, very embarrassing information gets out about Putin or something like that. We need to...
What would you do to embarrass Putin?
His BMI isn't what he claims.
Yeah.
He was photoshopped onto that bear.
Yes. I don't believe that's a real unicorn he's wrestling.
It turns out he doesn't actually drink vodka. It's actually he's actually a teetotaler, but he doesn't want to tell, you know. Yeah, that is the thing. What do you do to embarrass the strong man?
Well, you make him appear weak.
Yeah, you could, like, you know, forge a Viagra prescription for him. You know, that'd be really embarrassing.
Dirty tricks.
Yeah, dirty tricks, you know. I mean, Russia doesn't seem to be stable to me.
Hmm.
And I think I think Putin has this idea that if we expand, then we can reach some sort of stability. But the core isn't there for that.
I mean, it's hard to see what the next move is. I'm sure that Putin's thought about it. the obvious next step would be to reunite with Belarus, and kind of move toward completing this project that has begun in the Ukraine of reuniting kind of a greater Russia. Mm-hmm. And you've seen some of that in the Caucasus. I don't think that there's much mileage in Asia, but, you know, kind of putting back together the ethnic core of, you know, to the extent that there is now a Russian diaspora, an involuntary diaspora in other countries, mm-hmm. you can see that being put back together. I mean, there are bits of that in the Baltic states, but it would strike me as being pretty foolish to invade those. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think he's that stupid.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the game. I mean, the game is to go after soft targets.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, the Crimea is a soft target in every sense, because you can make a pretty straight-faced argument, and I have, that why is this even part of Ukraine in the first place? This is just, you know, the happenstance of Soviet mm-hmm. Engineering that it's there, and so, you know, if it would be difficult to gin up the kind of outrage required to put together a coalition to stop it, and mm-hmm. and verily that has not happened. Maybe a more skilled politician than Obama could have. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but it hasn't happened.
Yeah.
My main thought on the Russian thing is just how venal and desperate the reaction on the left has been. You know, the idea that a foreign power would hack any American organization is concerning, right? You mm-hmm. know, whether it's IBM, the DNC, whoever, it doesn't really make much difference.
Mm-hmm.
But to say that it invalidates the election and we should have a do-over, I mean, has the desperation on the left kind of calmed down at all at this point to avoid this kind of, avoid dealing with the reality that they lost? Has that simmered a little?
I think after December 19th, when the Electoral College voted, and it was quite clear that the outcome would be at least mostly representative of the votes that came in on election night, it simmered down a little, not mm-hmm. a lot.
It was kind of delightful how fast they went from Hamilton electors to, oh my gosh, people are voting. You know, there are lots of Hamilton electors, and they're all voting against Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
That was, you know, talk about be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting but not surprising that the two Republican electors who did not vote for Trump were both from Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Who did they vote for?
One of them voted for Ron Paul. I believe another voted for Kasich.
Yeah.
Mm. I was disappointed that no one voted for Berman Supreme. I thought that was clearly the choice. Yeah.
You know, his free pony and dental hygiene platform is mm-hmm. excellent.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even remember anything about it. I just remember Mike used the name one time. It's just like...
yeah.
It's a catchy name. I'll give him that.
Yeah, I think with Trump and the left, I think there's still a lot of shock, and it's just grasping at anything to say this isn't real.
Hmm.
Like, you know, this is, and I don't blame them for being shocked.
I was shocked. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm still shocked. We elected a reality TV host mm-hmm. as president of the United States.
But I think it may be easier for us because all the things that people from Camp Trump are saying with glee,
mm-hmm.
Or a lot of them, and a lot of the things that the people on the left are terrified that he may do are things we would be delighted to see him do. It's like, you know, oh my gosh, he might put someone like Scalia on the court.
Yeah.
Fabulous! I wish I believed it, yeah. But fabulous yeah. if he would. And so, you know, it's kind of a little easier. My anxiety that this clown is going to have the nuclear button is solved at least a little bit by the fact that his critics and his champions both claim that he's going to do things that I would like. Not to mention, and you know, I try not to indulge Schadenfreude too much, but it's just irresistible that. So you have these people who are saying, oh my gosh, Betsy DeVos is going to lead the Department of Education. And I'm like, I told you I didn't want it. I would get rid of it. And then she wouldn't have any fiefdom to rule.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just abolish it. We had education in human civilization before 1979 or whatever it was.
Yeah.
It's like, you have created this machine that a lot of us told you, don't create this machine. This is a bad machine. And now someone else is going to run this machine in ways mm-hmm. you don't approve, obviously.
Yeah.
Wouldn't the better solution be to just shut down the machine?
You know, while I'm placated by some of the choices, it still represents a coarsening. You know, this still represents a degradation. You know, we're going to have a president who's going to be spending his time engaging in Twitter fights. We're going to have a president who's engaging in the worst type of bread and circuses. We're already seeing this with, like, him touting out deals that have been made months before he was president as examples of him saving jobs. And it's amazing at how effective it is, and in the face of any actual numbers. And I really do think he's going to be, he's going to rule not as, like, we're going to have a shift of some sort of right nationalism.
Well, here's a question for you. Mm-hmm. How do you tell the difference between a false flag and trolling?
If it's been done by someone, so if it's someone who's like who's not actually a neo-Nazi or a Trump supporter, and they're doing it to try and cast Trump supporters in a negative light, I would call that a false flag. The church that was burnt down in, I want to say Mississippi. It was burnt down right after the election, and someone wrote vote, or right before the election, and wrote vote Trump on it. That was done by a member of the congregation.
The number of false flags is not 100%, but it certainly isn't 0%.
No, I would be comfortable in saying the number of false flags is approaching 90%.
I wouldn't want to go that far.
I don't know, that's how it's, especially in the post-election thing, that's how it's looking to me.
So if it was a Trump supporter and they were just out to kind of play on people's outrage and make them look bad, that would not be a false flag?
I wouldn't call that a false flag. I'd call that an asshole. An asshole who's way too comfortable with these terms. And there's a lot of those.
Yes, but I've seen quite a bit of that.
I'm thinking of, like, the church burning, or the defacing, or the supposed harassing of people in streets, all those major things.
Yeah, one of my friends who happens to be gay had someone message him on Facebook and say some very, very unkind things to him, and of course reference Trump as part of that, and saying, you know, things are going to change when the Trump administration comes in and that sort of thing, and it was pretty interesting. I mean, I saw screenshots of the conversation, so I knew it wasn't just palavering. But I mean, my guess is that there is a small percentage of them that are people really just being assholes. As we know, people can do that.
And who feel emboldened by it.
Yeah, they do, yeah. Assholes got one of their own in the office.
Yeah, unfortunately, those very vocal assholes take up most of the stage. And they seem a lot bigger and a lot more powerful than they are because of that.
See, now I'm just thinking of Spaceballs. Who is that man? He's an asshole, sir. I know that, but what's his name? Philip Q. Asshole. How many assholes we got on this boat? Yo! Did 2016 take Mel Brooks, or is he still with us?
He is still with us.
Okay, that's good. 2016 did take a lot of people, but people I have a theory about it. Yeah, as I say, the chap who played the chaplain on MASH died on New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
Or this was reported. But it's like, he's 85. That's a little different to Carrie Fisher dying at 60, which is in turn a little different to Prince overdosing on what have you. But I actually have a theory that this is going to get worse, not better, because we are on kind of the cusp of the generation of people who were the leading lights in the early wave of mass media in the 1960s are now approaching the point where they're going to be dying off of natural causes, and we'd expect them to. Plus, you have all the people who used substances to excess in the 70s and 80s and 90s, getting to a point where that stuff starts to bite on your health long term. Plus, you still have the same number of people who are in younger age doing various kinds of drugs that are potentially fatal. And so just the pool of people who are famous on a national level is much larger, and the number of people who are likely to be at life-endangering risk is much higher than it has been, and it's only going to get more so over the next few years. We might end up with 2017 being worse.
It's very possible.
Yeah. People die. It happens.
Mm-hmm. What else we want to talk about?
Well, I want to talk about the swamp.
You want to talk about the swamp?
Yes.
We're going to transition to the transition?
Yes, we're going to transition to talking about the transition team and how the transition team is transitioning the White House from a swamp to the best swamp.
The best swamp.
Is anyone on the transition team transitioning, as they say?
I think that's a mistake if there's not. There should be.
We have inadequate diversity.
Yeah.
We do. Yeah, there were fairly immediate calls for greater diversity on the Trump team after his various picks were announced. It strangely seemed like Donald Trump didn't care about making sure there was a certain number of women or ethnic minorities in his administration.
Fancy that.
Yeah.
I don't know how that would happen.
Yeah. It's almost as if he's using a different selection criteria.
Yeah, which seems to be people he thinks highly of.
What are his selection criteria? Because clearly it's not personal loyalty. Because, for example, Rudy Giuliani and Chris Christie both got stiffed, even though they were early high-profile backers. It's facile to say, well, Ben Carson got HUD because he was an early backer. But there were plenty of people who were early and publicly backed. Newt Gingrich is another one who seems to have gotten squat. So what is the selection criterion?
I think he has a group of people whispering in his ears, and he chooses from what those group of people say. I think that's what's going on.
In the way of like a Turner, for example. So you know, the bishops conference gives the Pope a list, and the Pope picks from
it. Exactly. Yeah, I think that's what's going on. I also think that he might actually not think highly of his early backers. He sees those guys as particular. He might see those guys as a particular brand of shysta for them to turn so quickly to back him for very opportunistic reasons. And so I think that might be why Ben Carson is rewarded, whereas everyone else has been left out in the cold.
So the theory is that Carson fought for the correct amount of time.
Exactly. Whereas Christie and stuff, these people are just too much turned around to opportunistically lick his boots, and he used them, and they're losers.
Could it just be that he just has no further use for them?
Yeah, I think that's part of it too. Yeah,
he's already neutered them. So what more does he need for them?
Well, personally, I'm really looking forward to the new Trump administration. I'm really waiting on the new signage on the White House.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be terrific.
The Trump House.
I need to dig at that. I think I sent you guys the photoshopped, the White House with the neon on the columns and on the sides, and then the glitz Trump logo across the top. I seem to remember doing that. At the time, it seemed funny. I'm not so sure anymore.
Yeah.
Well, now you should send it to the Trump transition team and see if they like it.
Yep.
Is it a copyright?
Yeah, we've got to put some schnaz in that swamp.
my mom and I were discussing the correct adjective to describe it. My parents just, funnily enough, went to Russia, among other places. They were on a cruise in the Baltic, and they went to St. Petersburg, and the Tsar's palaces are all just this kind of trying too hard nouveau riche by the standards of the time. And it's, you get the same impression looking at anything Trump. And you know, tacky's not really quite the right word, and chintzy's not really quite the right word. And so I think that we just need to use the obvious adjective. It's just so Trump. Like the Tsar's palace, it's so Trump. It's so nouveau riche and tacky and cheap. It's so Atlantic City where you want Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Trump needs to be the adjective for anything that's trying too hard and looks cheap by trying to appear expensive. Gold-plated plastic,
mm-hmm.
or gold-painted plastic, mm-hmm. perhaps I should say.
Yep. So.
Yeah, gold paint.
I can't wait to see the Oval Office painted gold.
That's what I'm thinking about too. Is the interior decorating is going to be fantastic, no doubt.
It's tremendous. Well, it's a way to leave a lasting mark on the White House. Maybe he'll paint the Washington Monument gold. Or plate it in gold.
And just call it the Trump Monument.
Yeah, call it the Trump Monument.
Yeah. Where do you think, I guess the only place he can put the presidential library, I guess he's going to try and bring it to New York, but, you know.
Well, library is a bit of a misnomer with Trump because he doesn't really read.
Well, yeah, it's all going to be art of the deal. Like, every book in there is just art of the deal.
Several thousand copies.
Yeah. Do you think he's ever read that?
No.
I'm sure he didn't write it, but
no,
Ghostwriter. The Ghostwriter publicly came out and
apologized.
Yeah.
I've been enjoying this season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. No, I'm kidding.
If he did that, if he bought the presidential library, he had the presidential library and just had it staffed with Art of the Deal, the federal government would have to purchase those copies of Art of the Deal. Right?
I mean, I think we're going to see a lot of that kind of soft corruption.
And then he'd get all the royalties. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I think we're going to see a lot of very interesting soft corruption. Do you think it's going to be the same level as the Clintons?
Yes.
Like,
Yeah, I mean, and that's the best case scenario.
I mean, because the Clintons really had that down to an art. Yeah. The tit for tat with the Clinton Foundation. And stuff like that. But I think, you know, I don't know if Trump likes land, you know?
He likes putting his name on things.
Yeah, he likes putting his name on things. So I think he'll be a bit more brazen about that, you know, sudden Trump towers in African countries.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have any hope
Trump
at all
diamonds.
For it. Yeah. I don't have any hope at all for this idea that he's going to divest himself of his business interests. And I had kind of assumed that this emoluments clause business was all a bit of a, you know, a partisan attack without much substance. But there was a paper that a few guys, I can't remember the two who actually did the work, but the person who put their name on it was Larry Tribe from Harvard. That went into it in some detail and established pretty convincingly, he is going to walk into office violating this clause. And then they get to a couple of pages explaining what can be done about this, and the answer is bugger all, basically. You know, the Electoral College could decline to vote for him, Congress could impeach him, and that's about it. And it's like, well, then I guess he's going to get away with it.
Well, here's what I suspect might happen. If he does get impeached for it, it won't be because Congress was super principled and had read their Constitution very well. It'll be because they'll note that they could impeach him for this, and they'll note several things that they might be able to impeach him for, and those things will kind of sit on a list. And then when it is convenient, then...
Or if convenient, yes.
Right, yeah. If there's a moment when Trump just seems to be getting out of hand and Congress is no longer getting any use out of him, then they have all sorts of cards just lined up that they can play.
Yeah, I think the one possible positive thing we see out of a Trump presidency is a strengthened Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, you know, I want to see hope against hope that Paul Ryan is able to stick to principles and keep Trump honest, try and keep the United States out of making extremely stupid decisions to the best of his ability.
Although, you know, the what just happened at the United Nations shows the strength of presidential unilateralism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that's something that can't be undone.
Yep.
But then the flip side is that all of this, these executive orders that Obama has done, that now look on very dicey footing,
yeah,
that may end up being pulled out, shows again the limits of that. So mm-hmm. maybe, you know, we'll see. I don't think we want to do predictions because we had such a lousy year of predictions last year. You know, it's like, yeah, it's difficult. We're in uncharted territory at this point. No one really knows what's going
to
happen.
Yeah, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens with all of these legalized drug states.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's.
My sense is probably not very much because I don't think that Trump really cares about that. The feds could now reassert the Controlled Substances Act. But the reality is, with Trump, they probably won't, unless Jeff Sessions gets a bill under his
seat. That's my thought. It isn't so much Trump, but Sessions.
I know we're not doing predictions, but I would bet that if there's any scalp that the Dems get, Sessions would be it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Everyone's thinking it's going to be Rex Tillerson. I don't think that's going to be it, but the Dems want a scalp.
Mm-hmm.
They are going to try. If they are in any way smart, they'll let most of them sail through and just focus on a couple of people. Tillerson looked like he would be low-hanging fruit, but it turns out he's actually quite polished and pretty good.
Yeah.
In person, where he isn't on paper. If I promise to be on good behavior, do you want to talk about Francis?
Let's talk about Francis for a little bit. So he's done some interesting things.
I swear
things.
To God, listener, I'm not the one who brought this up.
No, this was me.
This was me. I'm gonna stay out of it.
He's done some interesting things. So we've had a group of four cardinals issues. How do you Dubia. Yeah, issue a dubia asking for clarification in the latest encyclical about. Particularly about his stance on the on marriage, and Francis proxies have come down very, very hard on these people,
including our erstwhile Archbishop Joseph Tobin, mm-hmm. now Joseph Cardinal Tobin, which was rather disappointing.
Yeah, including like threatening to remove their cardinal, you know, the
that wasn't
their position.
But yes, that was, I can't remember who that was, but yeah, yes,
that was
did.
Like the head of the head of a major department in the Curia.
Mm-hmm.
And they continue to have cardinals join them.
Mm-hmm.
Francis, in an interview, referred to he referred to his detractors as having a fetish with excrement.
See, this is a polite Italian way of saying that they're talking shit.
Yeah.
You know, this is what he's driving at.
Yeah. And he is going after the Knights of Malta, which is a sovereign body.
That completely coincidentally happens to be headed by Cardinal Burke.
Yeah, what do you know?
Total coincidence.
What do you know?
Yeah.
And the Pope, because it is sovereign, the Pope does not have authority to remove the head or even really investigate into hierarchical matters within the Knights.
But he's sure going to try.
Yeah.
Well, they sent him a very politely worded letter that said that would not be possible.
Yes.
And they nonetheless had the greatest esteem for him.
Yes. Fraternal esteem, I think, was the phrase.
So, like...
And then, of course, you know, he had the annual Christmas spanking of the Curia.
Yeah.
Said that that people like me take refuge in tradition.
Yeah, yeah.
Like
how dare we take refuge in tradition?
Hold fast to the traditions that have been passed on to you, whether by our letters.
Gosh, yeah.
That bit must be missing from his scripture.
What's with all these people who hold on tradition, says to the leader of a 2,000-year-old church.
Yes. Holding fast to the traditions of the church is basically his job description, so it's rather revealing that he has so little use for it. So,
you know, I guess my question is, like, is Francis going crazy? Is he going to retire? Is he going to be kind of nudged in this direction?
My suspicion is that people are already nudging him in the direction of retirement.
Mm-hmm.
They're just not the people he's worried about right now.
Yeah.
And there may be a later time when that comes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not right now.
Not right now.
And my suspicion is that Pope Francis's understanding of what tradition means has to do with a lot of things he didn't like about the culture of Argentina when he was growing up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, he didn't like the fact that if someone was divorced, that people looked down on them. Or, you know, if someone was committing premarital sex, they weren't allowed to even be in your house. Or, you know, these kinds of cultural boundary-setting activities he thought were too harsh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he kind of looks at everything, as far as I can tell, through the lens of his upbringing in Argentina and says that kind of harshness doesn't lead people to Christ. We need to stop that. It's a big problem. And it seems like a big problem to him precisely because that's what was so prevalent in his formative years, not necessarily because that's the prevalent problem in the world today.
Or even in Argentina today, for that matter.
No, it's probably not at all in Argentina. You know, there are problems like that in some African countries.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be fair to address and say, okay, if you were some other pope than Pope Francis, I'm assuming, you would say, all right, it's good that you're Orthodox. We want you to hold fast to these traditions. Here's how we can be more effective as pastors and really draw people to Christ. Unfortunately, I don't think that's what he's going to do. You know, he's not going to look at what the situation of each country is. He's just going to make these kind of blanket statements that may or may not pertain to anything in the world today in any given location.
Mm-hmm.
Which was problematic enough when he was, you know, essentially the leading prelate of Argentina. It's really problematic now.
Especially in the age of mass media.
Yes, yes.
In a way that it wouldn't have been, you know, 400 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, from my perspective, not an awful lot has changed. You know, it's Francis gone Francis, right? He continues to hurl out an endless chain of invective. I completely agree. I think that's exactly right. That it's a product of his limited upbringing. What has changed is that I think a lot of people have just gotten tired of it.
Mm-hmm.
I got tired of it a long time ago,
mm-hmm.
And had, you know, kind of despaired on. It's like if you dug in enough that you're not going to get off the train now, then where have you been? But it seems like a lot of people. I follow a deacon in England on Twitter who was finally thrown in the towel and said, "I'm done with this," and is mm-hmm. getting on the train, so to speak.
Well, I think what people are noticing, like, his vindictiveness
mm-hmm.
is coming out. Like, it's really coming out in a way that was kind of hidden before. I think it was always there, but he's clearly getting frustrated that everybody's not on board with his ideas and his circular ways of getting there.
He's kind of the combination of the worst elements of Trump and Obama in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of why doesn't everyone just see how right I am?
Yeah, yeah.
And gets that's very much an Obama thing. You know, I'm going to build bridges by telling you I'm going over here and anyone is welcome to come with me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This is the way that we forge coalitions, right? We're going to just go to this destination I think is right, and, you know, whether you think it's right or wrong, you're welcome to come along. But he also has that kind of Trumpian thin-skinnedness,
mm-hmm.
and that's been apparent to people like me for quite a while. You know, there was literally the, you know, was it the Pope Francis' little book of insults? You know, that has been in circulation for a while. Last December, I collected the lowlights of all the various mean names he's called people like me, and it largely tuned out. But I'm sure that there's more that circulated than the last year. It wouldn't surprise me. But it does seem like more people are, as you say, noticing it now. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's just a function of that he's amping up the voltage on the attacks, or if it's just because time has gone on and people are—it's the act has worn thin.
I think we've hit peak rebuke. You know, he definitely seems to see it as his role as Pope to rebuke sinners, mm-hmm. which is fine. I don't have a problem with him seeing that as his role. If he were better at it, that would be great. The problem I see facing him now is nobody cares that Pope Francis rebukes them anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, they've kind of settled into their camps. Either they think his opinion matters, but it only matters to other people than them because they're on his side, or they think his opinion doesn't matter, and so his rebukes are just kind of out there hanging around. Mm-hmm. And not bothering anyone anymore. So one of the things that really is a problem here is that he's kind of backed himself into a bit of a corner. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got these grand ideas about decentralizing the church, but the only way for him to decentralize the church is to act in a very authoritarian, centralized manner. Mm-hmm. And so the only way you can do that with a pretense of decentralization is to get everybody on your side in the synods. And that is clearly not going to happen.
Yeah.
Or you can rig the synods by stacking who attends them and say, hey, we had synodality. You know, granted, right. It was a manufactured synodality that had, you know, a couple of high-profile opponents. I mean, because when you think about it, so this is how, if you were Putin, to loop back to the earlier thing, you know, and you were going to have an all-Russia constitutional convention, and your goal was to have them recreate the Tsarist constitution, right, and proclaim you are going to be the Tsar of all the Russias. The smart way to do that is you invite Kasparov, and you invite other high-profile critics, because then no one can say, hey, listen, there was no voice of dissent heard. So you invite Cardinal Burke to your synod, but you just make sure that the votes are wildly stacked against him. Mm-hmm. You know, and even when they do come dangerously close to prevailing on striking down a section, you just say, you know, it's just a study text, so we're going to include that line anyway. You know, yes, it didn't gain enough votes, but we're going to include that anyway. And then we've seen the results of that, because in the last few weeks, I think, didn't Father Hollowell post a thing that was basically claiming, oh yes, from the beginning the synod included this text. Only it wasn't included by the synod, it was rejected by the first synod and included by Francis's direction. And now 3 years down the line, they can just say, ah, oh, well, but it's in the report. Because who goes and looks at the legislative history of this? Mm-hmm. It all gets memory-holed and forgotten. And so he can claim, hey, I'm just following what the synod said. Which I seem to remember some of us said at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, so his problem with doing that is people are now wise to the game. And even the people who might otherwise have been more on his side, some of those people are going to be very suspicious about how things played out at the last synod. And so I think in the future those sorts of maneuvers will be less effective, in the sense that people will be aware, look, this may happen, particularly on controversial topics. And part of me wonders if that's not why the topic of the upcoming synod was changed to something less controversial.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that becomes less true, though, as he makes over the clergy with appointments. It's all well and good to have four cardinals say something, but that's not an awfully large number. Although the other side to that is that the more of them retire and so are beyond the reach of retribution. I mean, it's interesting that he said, you know, that we may strip them of their red hats. Mm-hmm. Well, because that's the only thing that's left. Right?
Yeah.
You can threaten Cardinal Dolan, right? Mm-hmm. You can say you are never going to get that Vatican job that you want so badly if you don't shut your mouth, right? Mm-hmm. So you can threaten someone who still wants to climb up the ranks, but someone who has already been punished by being removed from all their Vatican jobs and sent to, I don't know, say the Knights of Malta, for example. Not that I'm naming names.
How could he cause trouble there?
Right. Yeah, how could he cause trouble there as the head of a sovereign order that I have no power over? He's not even a very good chess player, right? <You know? laughs> Maybe we should go back to Monopoly or something. Ooh, capitalism. But as he shuffles people out of those positions and out of the kind of the chain of power, then they no longer have anything to lose, and so the number of people willing to publicly criticize goes up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you'll notice that most of those people, with a few exceptions, who have joined on that train, are people who are no longer subject to sanction, short of, you know, the nuclear option. But this is the thing, right? If you start going around stripping people of red hats, where does that end?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe it ends at the next conclave. You know, what happens there?
No, I don't think he's going to be able to stack something to permanently alter the church and his image. I don't think he's going to be successful.
I'm more pessimistic than you about that, because the only thing that's harder to do than to get particularly men, but not exclusively men, but particularly men, the only thing harder than getting them to admit that they made a mistake is getting them to stab a patron in the back. And the next conclave will consist of two classes of men. Men who voted for Bergoglio before, the last one, and men who owe their being there to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got to persuade people who voted for him before and who owe their appointments to him to admit that there was a mistake made last time and we want to go in a different direction. Mm-hmm. That doesn't strike me as very likely. I think it's far more likely that they will try and continue.
I mean, I think you can get people who voted for him before. I think there are a significant number of people who voted for him before who think that, oh, we made a mistake. I think that's likely. I mean, you know, he's not going to be able to... I mean, we do have the JP2 Cardinals dying off and retiring.
But he was a JP2 Cardinal.
Yeah, yeah. You know.
Yeah, I would be much more of a John Paul II fan had he actually been what the National Catholic Reporter thinks he was.
Yeah.
But, you know, think of all these people. You know, Roger Cardinal Mahony owes his red hat to John Paul II.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bergoglio owed his red hat. I think he was made a bishop by Paul VI, if memory serves.
Hmm.
Can't blame that one. But, you know, he was appointed nevertheless, and there are plenty of goopic. If in Chicago was appointed by Bergoglio, but he was made a bishop by Benedict, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it's kind of like saying, well, David Souter was a Republican appointment. Well, yeah that's true.
Yeah.
But that doesn't really mean much. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
Do you think it's more likely that we'll move in a different direction if he dies than if he retires?
Well, if he's alive, you'll get a large crowd of people protesting that. If you do change direction, it's, you know, a flat-out insult to him. Either way, I guess you would get that.
Isn't that, you can make the same argument with Benedict, except that the other side is generally more shameless.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, my big fear is if he retires, he's going to start giving daily interviews from his villa.
Oh, no. It'll be on airplanes.
Yeah,
that's where all the best interviews happen.
He'll just be flying everything. He's going to be just in coach. I'll be in coach on the United flight, and he's going to stand up and be like, okay, I'm taking questions.
Yep.
What does the Obama post-presidency look like? Will he be just sitting in coach asking for interviews? What does that look like? You think he'll hang around and make a best of himself?
I think he's going to want to go... I think Michelle's going to tell him, okay, honey, it's my turn for my career. You get to stay home with the kids.
Please, can we pass your constitutional amendment? Please.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, here's what's interesting. Obama gave an interview recently in which he said that he owed it to Michelle to take a lot of time off and spend a lot more time with her.
Yeah.
And so, you know, hopefully he does that. I sincerely hope that he gets a nice retirement.
Mm-hmm. 2, maybe 3 decades would be nice. Yeah. Take some time. Take a load off.
Well, he's got a lot of reflection to do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so much work that he did, you know, it must take some time to...
It is rather interesting in the lame duck part of the Obama presidency. We actually see in Obama presidency, like at least a second term of the Obama presidency, with some sort of balls, you know, like they're actually doing something.
A lot more presidential pardons.
Yeah, we've got presidential pardons. We've got the president like taking vast parts of the West and declaring it all monuments, so that way us greedy capitalists can't touch it. You know, he's going after Russia.
What happened with this Dakota Access Pipeline thing? Do either of you follow that at all?
That's been nixed.
Is that in the same category? Is that something that he's done, or is it just...
That's something that he's had influence over. The Army Corps of Engineers, like, revoked the easement.
Hmm.
They told them, oh, sorry, because even though you've been planning this for years and put tons of money into this and had studies, we're no longer going to let you go over here. It's in a similar category. I think... You know, the larger pipeway from Canada to the U.S. is something else that he stopped and can be changed rather quickly.
Can that ever qualify as a taking, do you think, if the government induces a private party to spend money under what could arguably be false pretenses?
Mm-hmm.
And then revokes it and leaves the private party high and dry. Is that ever a taking?
I guess we'll find out if they sue.
I would not be surprised at all if someone does, because it's America. You know, litigation is the national pastime. I'm sure that Richard Epstein is writing the article as we speak.
Yeah,
and I'm sure that Donald Trump will be thrilled. He'll be like, lawsuit, excellent. These are my kind of people.
Mm-hmm. That may end up on the cutting room floor. Now I think more about it. Let's poke the bear.
Yeah.
I think the good news is that we're not reaching a sufficiently wide audience
that
you have to worry about
that,
Simon.
I don't think we can count on the 3 people who are listening not to say anything to Jeff Sessions, right?
But those 3 people are tremendous.
They are tremendous. You guys are all huge.
Yeah.
The best. We have the best listeners.
That's true.
Yeah, if we went out and shot someone right now, our listeners would definitely stop listening to us, which means they're pretty great.
You guys are the best.